that payment is contingent on future performance. That brings with it complexities after the deal in terms of not necessarily having all incentives aligned across the organization, maybe difficulty in giving credit for cross-sold revenue or just the accounting for expenses, things like that. So it's not as clean, but it's certainly done very frequently. So that's that earnout is another important element for people to think about.
Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. Today, we'll have a look at Jonathan Rothenberg's recipe for success when we talk about corporate development and M&A, because I think it's a huge topic that felt a bit too easy throughout the last 2 or 3 years in the hype cycle that we had in the startup ecosystem. And there is a lot of stuff to talk about and to revisit on how companies on an M&A side think about opportunities and look at opportunities. Jonathan is the chief strategy officer at Cytheris, and Cytheris provides the people, process, and technology modern enterprises rely on to manage risk, maintain compliance, and respond to security threats with greater speed, scale, and cost efficiency than traditional in-house solutions. I think you might, some of you might know one of the founders of Cytheris. It's Robert, who is also part of Shark Tank. Me as a German, I'm not watching Shark Tank too often, but when I was in the US, I watched it quite often and I enjoyed it. So therefore, back to Jonathan. Jonathan is focused on M&A for more than 20 plus years. So a lot to learn from. And I'm super happy to open up the black box on corporate development and M&A together with you. Jonathan, welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Hi, Fabian. Thanks for having me.
Let's quickly start with the first, like more on the definition side before we come back to your story a bit. But what's your definition of being successful in corporate development, M&A, the whole topic of mergers and acquisitions, which is like something that everybody talks about, but I think a lot of people don't really know what it actually means to do it well.
Well, one definition of success is getting deals done, but that's just a near-term proximate kind of viewpoint. Ultimately, what you want to do is create long-lasting, sustained value for your company, the acquiring company, by bringing in additional capabilities, talent, whatever it is, through acquisitions, where you can look back and hopefully tangibly and quantifiably be able to point to value creation and accretion for equity.
Without pointing to specific deals and name them, but what deals didn't work out that you do throughout your career?
Well, fortunately, I would say I can't really think of deals that blew up that were total catastrophes, but I think from time to time you run into acquisitions where it just didn't click in terms of creating the synergies that you're looking for. And in my past and through my career, I've always been working for technology companies or technology-enabled companies. And typically in this industry, we do acquisitions for growth synergies, meaning revenue. There are other instances or other contexts where companies are doing roll-ups or other types of strategies, and they're certainly looking for growth, but they're also very heavily reliant on cost synergies and cutting out duplicative G&A, for example. So in my experience, the ones that didn't work out are the ones that just didn't create those revenue synergies, at least as much as we would have hoped.
A friend recently told me, if you as a startup and a growth scale up, let's put it that way, look at M&A, you're officially or you're slightly admitting to your shareholders that your current business model is not growing at a fast enough rate anymore and you need to find different revenue streams to keep the growth coming. Would you agree on that, or would you say that's not 100% true?
Yeah, I would say that's not 100% true. There are plenty of reasons to engage in M&A as a buyer, and plenty of them that are not about replacing or covering up for declining organic growth. You obviously could be looking at new market opportunities where your company doesn't currently play, and that has nothing to do with your existing business, for example.
What kind of company, and like, not what kind of company do I have to be to think about M&A, but also what should I have solved for myself to start thinking about M&A? Because I think for a lot of companies that I saw throughout the last years, mostly earlier stage startups starting to be into the growth phase, they just took on companies and were like, yeah, we're now acquiring companies. And you're like, are you even focused on your core product? So when is the right time to start thinking about M&A first?
As a seller, there are so many different types of companies, and therefore there's no one answer to that question. It really depends. In the technology world, a lot of companies are formed that really end up being features or at best products as opposed to companies. And so those kinds of startups or early stage tech oriented companies that, again, that are features really or products, but not companies, would think about it differently than a different kind of business that maybe truly is a standalone business that for whatever reason, whether it's the founders or investors' time horizons on when to gain liquidity, or feeling that they've tapped out their ability to grow with current capacity, current financials, current talent, whatever it is, and want a partner to help with the next stage of growth. You have companies where the sale is truly the exit and they're out and they monetize everything. Others that want to stay involved in the business and continue to grow. So there's so many different scenarios and permutations that ultimately for each entrepreneur, each business owner, you really have to start back to first principles of why you started the company, not only what you sought to achieve, what market opportunity you sought to exploit, but also from a personal, or if you're a VC or more of a professional investor, what the goal was for that investment.
And from a buyer's perspective, when am I grown up enough to start acquiring companies?
When you're grown up as a buyer enough to be a buyer yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good question. I would say when you feel that you've got a good handle on your own business, number one, I think it's really a dicey proposition to start acquiring when you don't have your own house in order. Now, maybe there are some businesses that are set up sort of as a shell to go out and roll up an industry. So maybe that's a unique kind of case, but you should have a strong enough handle on your business, on your market, so that you can conduct due diligence and make an assessment of the strategic fit and the degree to which your target companies are actually achieving for themselves, but then ultimately for you, if you buy them, what the goals are.
I think it's a good timing to also ask, okay, let's say you're currently in the buying position. How do I assess my target? How do I understand if the company is actually something I should buy? And let's start from here before I try to find all the small ways out of the deal again. But I think, like, what are the main things I need to understand to validate a deal or opportunity?
So I actually prefer to take it a few steps backward from there. In my view, if you're starting from the position of looking at a particular target and then figuring out where it makes sense, that's actually later than where I would like to make that assessment. The ideal situation for me is first you start off with looking at your own business as the buyer and determining what are the gaps we want to fill, what are the opportunities we want to exploit, what are the types of companies in abstract that we want to acquire, and make a prioritization. And just a handful, if you have too many priorities, obviously you don't have any at all. So just a handful of actual priorities of archetypes, really, of the kind of target you want to acquire. Then you've got that template, and then you can go out and do a market search, do a bunch of desktop research, talk to industry participants and so on, build your target list. And then you have an objective standard, that template against which you can compare all of the potential targets. And that way keeps you honest to your strategic rationale. And it also makes it more difficult to do what I see all too often, which is to come upon a target that it's actionable and it's available, and then you end up reverse engineering your strategic rationale to acquire it.
I have the feeling the smaller and the younger a company is, the more opportunistic they think about this process.
You're probably right about that. I think, for example, if a company has some professional investors, they have some VCs who've been around the block a few times, maybe they can bring some of that perspective and that experience to it, to be more programmatic as opposed to more opportunistic. And what I described before is really about having a thematic or programmatic approach to M&A as opposed to a more reactive or opportunistic approach.
On the one hand, it's definitely on the team side, because you don't have the budget to also have a corporate development team that's that senior already. Maybe you don't even have a person that's just like, hey, we should think about X. And then you look at opportunities like who might be on the market. And at the same time, it's also that maybe you're just too young to acquire companies, and that's, and you're just like, this could be an idea. And like, it's all of this like little sparks instead of, as you said, the really assessing, like the self-assessment that you then use to identify possible growth and growth opportunities, and also maybe even product innovations. And because I think what a lot of, and you mentioned it, it's often to drive revenue, but it can, what do you think about it being developing or like improving the product through acquisition that then drives the revenue? Like then the implication of we improve the product and then therefore we will see more customer satisfaction or a new customer segment, and that's how we will make more revenue in the long run. Yeah. And not in the short term.
Absolutely. 100%. You're right about that. So it's not simply taking the target P&L and adding it to your P&L and simple arithmetic and you have new revenue. It's really about what value creation can take place by putting two sets of assets of capabilities together. And so you're right about either acquiring technology or whatever the attribute is that enhances your own offering as the buyer, whether it's products or services, to be able to then translate into more revenue. If you do it with, I think, the proper kind of rigor and discipline, what you do is translate that into a business case with numbers, and then you're able to look back retrospectively and really compare performance of the acquisition against your business case and see if you've achieved those goals. So the qualitative elements of the fit ultimately should be able, in some amount at least, to be quantifiable and then be able to go back and measure that.
So might be a bit of a trivial question, but how much of your time is then spent internally to talk to head offs, leaders, whoever, and then make decisions on the fields that you want to improve the company at, and then also at the same time talking to external people to figure out, okay, what opportunities you want to chase further?
Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't really kept track of that, but it feels sort of like 50-50, actually. There's a lot of not only internal deliberation about prioritization, and of course priorities change over time, especially in a fast-moving industry like cybersecurity, where I currently am, or prior industries like analytics or software engineering. So that's a constant, I would say, a continuous process. But then so much of the work also is maintaining relationships with bankers, investors, doing just my own research, finding companies based on our criteria that we set out for acquisitions that we want to make.
Interesting question that I have in my mind right now that came up, and might sound a bit funny, but how much do you have to align your interest in buying companies with also making the right strategic decision as a company to say, okay, we want to think about expanding our business growth-wise, product-wise, etc. So we could buy all of these businesses, and then you have to niche down to, let's say, one or two acquisitions a year. I'm just making up the number. It has nothing to do with your current job, and the current companies you're buying. And you then have to say, okay, we have an opportunity list that we could buy because of all the areas we want to do or could develop, and then we have to niche it down to focus areas. But how aligned are the values here? Because you might think, hey, I would love to buy all these companies, and at the same time, you can only buy a certain amount of companies to even grow strategically and also responsibly.
Sure. So are you talking about specifically alignment between my own personal preferences and what the company's priorities are, or just as a company altogether, being able to do as much as we can do as opposed to everything we want to do?
More the inner conflict of being in the role of, okay, I have to think about all the possibilities, and then even when I want to do all of them, I have to shrink them down to prioritize one or two.
Yeah. So MA is similar to many other disciplines in a number of ways, one of which is knowing when and how to say no. Whether it comes to organic growth, when companies are growing, one of the challenges that we see, and this may be a lesson for founders actually who are thinking about being acquired, one of the lessons that we see, and I've seen in my own companies that I've worked for, is it's hard to say no, but you really do have to say no sometimes, and meaning no to business, and especially when you're young, it's hard to say no to new business and new clients and new revenue streams. But it's important to know what you're good at, what you're not good at, what drives your business model. So if you've got a good delivery model, a good business model, it operates efficiently and generates good margins, but you sort of pollute it by taking on these opportunistic inbound situations that deviate from your core, that can cause problems over time, and those problems can snowball over time. So similar in M&A, there's an opportunity cost to doing anything. And so I don't really view it as a conflict. I think it's just an inherent requirement of this role, is understand that there are trade-offs. And I think actually not just in M&A, not just in business, I think throughout society, actually, you can see that there's a lack of understanding of what that concept of trade-offs means, that for every decision that's made, there are positives and negatives, and every decision that's not made, or every situation or every opportunity that is foregone, you've foregone that opportunity, but also you've gained things maybe that are hard to measure or quantify. So being able to prioritize, being able to say no, and being able to keep the blinders on and stick with the program is an absolute necessity.
I think that's so interesting, because everybody, I would think, okay, hey, I'm very opportunistic and like shiny object syndrome from time to time. So I'm like, oh, we could do something here and there. And like prioritizing is so hard for me sometimes, and I can imagine for a lot of other people. So what are the indicators when you're like, okay, I know this could be a good fit, but it's not good enough. Like, where is the fine line between it's good enough and not good enough? Because it's definitely a grayscale that's like super thin and not very like black and white.
Right. So one of the other lessons for me from M&A is there's no such thing as the perfect acquisition target. Every target, every deal has hair, as we call it, has hair in some way. There is something that's maybe a little extraneous from the business that doesn't exactly fit in yours. The valuation may be out of whack. Maybe something about the financial profile isn't 100% as you like it. There's no such thing as the rainbow colored unicorn that is perfect and has no imperfections. So that's why, going back to what I talked about, that programmatic approach and having that template or that archetype in advance of going out to look at targets, that gives you that lodestar to come back to, that you have that constant, that constant comparison point that you can compare back to every target you look at. And then the more that you look at and the more that you evaluate, the more then you start to understand, okay, what are the trade-offs that I have to make? Am I willing to make trade-offs in financial performance because this has the best technology, or this really has the best management team that I like, and maybe they don't have the best clients, but I really want that management team. And so as long as you're intentional and you're deliberate about looking at not just the benefits, not the positives, but also the negatives or the weak elements of your potential target list, then you can start to make those comparisons and trade-offs.
It's interesting. I just thought about, okay, how would I assess it? Would I look for enough reasons to say yes or enough reasons to say no? And as I have maybe too many opportunities, let's put it in quotation marks, that I could buy potentially, because there's always enough space for development and growth, I think I would rather look for enough boxes to check to say no, to prioritize quicker. I'm not sure if that's the right thing, and definitely, but it would be the easy mind game that I would play at first to get myself into the space.
Yeah. Well, a colleague of mine once said, due diligence is a negative exercise. And I like that phrase, and I've used it myself. And what that means is whenever you're going in to look at a company after you've penetrated, after you've looked at the website, you've heard all the great things about it, once you get into due diligence, that's where you really uncover that hair that I talked about earlier. And due diligence being a negative exercise means you've probably already heard everything good, all the sell job and the spin and the positioning, and now you're uncovering all the weak points or you know where the skeletons are buried. So that's a totally normal part of the process. And if your mindset is predisposed to look for reasons not to do the deal, you probably always find a reason not to do a deal. So it's not on an absolute scale. It's really on a relative scale.
Fair enough. I think one question that I have, because I'm more from the startup side earlier stage, and I saw a lot of valuations skyrocket through the hype cycle in 2020, 2021. And you mentioned that valuations are sometimes like too high or whatever. How do you look at the current market?
I'm a buyer. Valuations are always good.
What are the current market developments? Like, how is it, what do you see in general about the acquisition market? Are there more or less acquisitions compared to, let's say, 2020, 2021 now? Because like it's super hard to say from a founder perspective, if you're like too deep into the woods and in the earlier stage right now. Like, how does it change? Like, what is the current market environment for, let's say, selling my company?
Yeah. So obviously, as interest rates have gone up, and equity markets have gone down or sideways or whatever, but certainly it's different than it was in 2020, latter part of 2020 and 2021. That always has an impact on the market. And usually what I've seen in past cycles is when there's a re-rating of valuation from higher to lower, it takes a while for sellers to internalize that new reality and come to grips with what their company is worth in the new environment. This time around, it seems like that has happened more rapidly, and maybe just everything in life is happening more rapidly now than before. But it seems like that realization has now set in. So I would say a few quarters ago, things were pretty slow. And in the past few months, I think the activity is starting to ramp back up at new, more, from my perspective, reasonable valuation levels that sellers have come to terms with.
Besides valuations, what are the biggest changes in the deals? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. One element to add to that is the debt factor. So obviously debt is more expensive than it was, and I think probably less available than it was also. So that plays a role, an important role into the valuations also, in terms of especially sponsor-backed companies being able to fund acquisitions.
So besides the valuations that are obviously changing, coming down, what are the implications for the actual deal? Like, how do the terms change? What do I have to, what am I getting myself into now when I'm selling a company? Because a lot of deals that we saw with a lot of the super high valuations was a lot of asset deals. Like, you get a lot of shares for the valuation. So that's, if you're selling a company for $1 billion, then a lot of that was also issued in shares and not too much in cash often. Of course, there were exceptions, but are buyers now still interested in buying in options? Are they interested in buying with cash because they know we are now at more reasonable priced valuation levels? Like, how do deals get together now? What changes?
Yeah, if you have the cash, I think certainly you want to use the cash. Equity is more expensive than cash usually. When you're talking about using equity consideration as part of a deal, then you're getting into a relative valuation discussion, meaning what's the valuation of the target relative to you, the buyer? The more of a disparity there is with you hopefully being higher and the target being lower, then the more accretive you can make that to be. The more important element, though, of purchase consideration, I think, is the deal structure and how that plays into the kind of operation that you want going forward. So if it's really important for you to have the management team incentivized, to have skin in the game, and to be committed, maybe you actually do want to have some equity in there, even if you're able to fund the whole thing in cash, because that business imperative is ultimately more important maybe than the near-term spreadsheet answer that you get.
So I think it makes sense to also quickly talk about the most common terms that we have in such a deal structure. So I think we talked about valuation, we talked about cash and equity options. But what is in there besides that that can be in different variations, obviously, because every deal is different. But what terms are in a signed deal agreement?
Right. So usually there would be a combination of upfront consideration, meaning at the time the deal is closed, here's your purchase consideration, whether it's cash or whether it's stock. And there also would often be some kind of earnout component. And what earnout is a portion of the purchase consideration that's held back for future achievement of objectives. Usually earnouts are used to bridge a valuation gap where obviously the buyer maybe doesn't have confidence as much in the financial projections as the seller does. And so they use an earnout to bridge that gap and say it's that payment is contingent on future performance. That brings with it complexities after the deal in terms of not necessarily having all incentives aligned across the organization, maybe difficulty in giving credit for cross-sold revenue or just the accounting for expenses, things like that. So it's not as clean, but it's certainly done very frequently. So that's that earnout is another important element for people to think about. There's also another element of holdback that's not really a part of valuation. So I don't know if this is the right area to talk about it in, but there's often an escrow that is held back by the buyer to back the what's called reps and warranties. So when a seller is selling a company, there's a portion of the purchase agreement that lists all the representations that they make about their business, that they're compliant with laws, that they recognize revenue in a certain way, that they don't know of any problems with client relationships, or that they don't have any employee issues, things like that. And these are pages and pages of legal terminology in purchase agreements. And the escrow is held for a certain period of time just in case that there's been a breach of one of those representations and warranties. So if everything's okay, the buyers get it all back, no problem. The sellers get it all back. So I'm sorry, the sellers get it all back, no problem. But just something for sellers to know that usually at the closing of a deal, there will be that part of escrow that's also kept behind that they'll have to wait.
It's interesting. I have to put it in here right now. It's more on a funny side, right? For us too, maybe, but not for the company. Wasn't there the case that JP Morgan bought a company for a very high valuation, and that was like completely built on like bots and more like anything but real value, and they paid out most of the exit immediately, and the founder, she was a female, but doesn't really matter. It's more that she then, and that's why I needed to state that she then also ran away with all the money and bought everything she wanted already, so that when they wanted to charge her and get the money back, it was not there anymore, and now they have to sue her for sure, and she will definitely go to jail. And it's interesting, like, how sometimes also, and I think this is also due to the hype cycle, due diligences are not made that clearly, maybe, or people were very good in hiding. But it's crazy that there is not much more safety measure or safety guards that were placed so that she could spend all the money. Everything was already a done deal, and nobody uncovered that it was a very, very, very bad deal that imploded.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of why due diligence is so important, and real due diligence, not just check the box, go through the motions due diligence. For me, one of the most salient examples of that, at least in recent times that I can remember, is FTX. It wasn't an acquisition, it was investment, but you had some really big brand name global investors who put money in, and it seems like the due diligence was certainly less than what I would have expected. And maybe you can be a little influenced by your reputation or something like that, but you really have to do your due diligence. I always use outside accounting advisors, outside legal advisors, and you really have to make sure you do the work. There's no replacement for doing the work, and then matching up your due diligence findings with the provisions of the purchase agreement, like the reps and warranties and the escrow that I mentioned. If those are all in sync, then you've done your work.
It was just so crazy when I read the headlines. One thing I wanted to mention, I know a lot of founders who sold their companies already, and about the earnout, a good proportion of them left the companies they sold to before the earnout, not taking, or even when they, that meant they had to give up millions, if not tens of millions of dollars. And it, I'm just curious what you think might be the reasons for that. And then afterwards I can share what I think, but it's just interesting to see. I know so many founders who left millions on the table.
Well, first of all, let me preface my answer by saying that I really would love to be in a situation where I can leave tens of millions of dollars on the table, number one. But in a situation like that, it sounds like they knew either very early on, or it just evolved over time, that they recognized that there's no way they're going to hit that earnout, and they have enough money that it's just not worth it to them. The marginal utility for somebody with a lot of money, of more money, might be less than the marginal utility of time. And for everybody, that's a different equation. But I think it probably comes down to that in the situation that you described. There's another, I won't call it a flavor of earnout, but there's another element of purchase consideration actually that's retention. So earnout is future contingent payments based on performance. Retention is just future contingent consideration paid on being there. And so that's another sort of flavor or version of holding people and keeping them incentivized, that it would have been the same outcome in the situation you just described. If they left, they wouldn't get either of those. But back to your question about why somebody would do that, like I said, they must have realized that it's just never going to happen. And why should they spend the time there knowing that if they've got the money they want to have?
I think performance is definitely one of the things, especially if you sold on the hype cycle and then it was just not possible to keep up with the performance. At the same time, as you mentioned, that's also what I thought. If you, and let's be honest, like 0.1% of founders ever get into the situation of selling a company and making like 10 to 30 million from it. Let's put it down, like just a number on it to make it easier for my example. If I have 20 million on my bank account now after an exit, it might not make the huge difference to have 3 to 5 million more. And they thought, okay, it would be cool to have the number for the exit. And then they realized it's also cool enough to have X percent of money less on the bank account. And now they're like, okay, I can spend 2 more years here. If you're talking about the dependency on like, how long am I staying with the company? Or I could use these 2 years to travel or to work on something new. And because otherwise the IP belongs to the company I'm with right now. So there are so many things, but I would say the moment that you have a substantial amount of money on your bank account, it's also that if the earnout is not too crazy incentivized, that you're like, okay, why should I spend my time here? I can also do something else with my time, think about new stuff. Even if it's taking time off, which a lot of founders not do during their bringing like time of bringing a startup from 0 to 1. So a lot of potential reasons, and it's just interesting that because I saw it so often, and it's super hard to ask them directly, like, why did you leave? And nobody will tell you, hey, it's because the performance was not there. It's always another reason, and that's totally fair, and I don't judge that. It's more like an observation.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out here also that what you will typically find as a seller in selling your company, in addition to all the other provisions, is there should be, I always insist on it, a non-compete provision. So as a seller, I want to make sure that the person or the people who are selling their company to me aren't going to turn around the next day and just build a new competitor. So I always get at least a couple of years, usually it's more than a couple of years, several years of non-compete. In the United States, there are certain states where there's effectively no such thing as a non-compete as an employee. So in California, for example, employees are free to leave a company and go to a competing company anytime they want, and non-competes are not enforceable. There's a difference, though, being a selling shareholder. If you're a selling shareholder, then those non-competes are much stronger and much more enforceable. And as a seller, you should expect to be bound by a non-compete.
Fair enough. Often they think about, okay, can we do something completely new, which would then be fine. But yeah, that's also a valid point. I had something in mind that I wanted to ask, but I think I lost it for a second.
MSB, I talked too long.
No, it's more my, I'm getting old. It's my brain. No, I'm joking, but it's more on the, let me think a second. What was it? We were talking burnout.
Or people leaving companies.
Ah, yeah, perfect. Especially because of the people and the founders that I know who left companies before getting their earnout, I always have the feeling of, okay, buying the management team, which is an incentive that a buyer might have to have the management team on board to lead a product division or to integrate into the another leadership team, depending on the exact case. How well does it function to keep these people in the company? Because as I only see the examples of founders, then sometimes, or often, in my opinion, rapidly leaving the company, how well does it work for management teams? Do they stay? Is it something that is actually working well because they are not the people getting maybe a substantial amount of cash up front because they're not the founders? Like, how well does it work? And for me, it feels like, okay, maybe it doesn't really work because I only know the founders leaving afterwards.
So you're talking about management employees who aren't selling shareholders and how successful they tend to be when being acquired? Is that correct? Yeah, so I found that actually to be quite successful in a number of situations, especially where the new management team that has come in via acquisition is part of a new initiative or is leading a new kind of area that the acquiring company doesn't already have, or where they just don't have the critical mass that they want. And again, being at growth companies, talent is always one of the constraining factors or one of the challenges, is hiring enough talent, enough of the right talent. So usually there's enough space for bringing new people in. And also usually if you're going from a small company that's been acquired to the bigger acquirer, that will mean broader opportunities, whether it means operating on a more global basis. Maybe your company was only regional or national, and then you get to be on a more worldwide platform. Maybe it means instead of working with small and medium-sized businesses, you're working with more enterprise businesses, and that's more exciting. But there's often, I think, attractive career paths for acquired management teams, and I've seen that work out very well.
Okay, interesting. As I said, I'm just too much into the founder perspective here, and therefore it also felt like, okay, maybe that's something to question. So that means the post-merger integration with the team side, are you then also, when you make an offer, are you calculating with the risk that the high risk that founders are leaving and you're just taking the team without the founders?
I wouldn't say that I count on that or that I am expecting that, but the more that you can have succession planning in place or just mitigating plans in place in case that happens, obviously the better off you'll be. I think the incentive for people to stay being financial is just a one part of the equation. I think it's really important both for the sellers and for the buyer to be very candid and open upfront in the negotiations or just the discussions as they're getting to know each other, to really talk through what is the investment thesis, what is the integration plan, and not necessarily a detailed integration plan, but generally speaking at a high level, how do they view the businesses coming together? What is the ambition? What is the growth plan? The more open and the more transparent that the buyer can be with the seller, I think then the more confident you can be that anything they say about being committed to it post-deal, that you can rely on that a little bit more. I really do believe very strongly that that openness and that candor about the future state ultimately will help alleviate more problems, and that the more secretive it is, the more problems you'll create.
So to bring it back to the founder perspective, if I'm asking for a structured process of like going into the process of M&A, I should have made my thoughts, what I am willing to offer, like also about the founding team and what we want. We should have pretty realistic market, like think realistically about what the market offers right now, and not go in with our last VC valuation, maybe if we got that in 2020 and 2021. And we then also have to think about, are there actually amazing synergies? Because otherwise, on the one hand, my team might not be happy going to the new partner. The new partner might cancel the process anyway. And at the same time, to find a new hub and a new home for my company, it just makes sense to think about the synergies more than, let's say, just the price.
Yeah, I think founders are often much more focused on what does the future look like for me or for my employees than a financial investor who's not really part of the business and certainly not going to be part of it post-closing. So especially for smaller companies where the founder may really know every single employee. They may have met everybody before they were hired. Smaller startups and founder-led companies often are more sort of like a family than bigger companies, certainly. And so they often place a greater emphasis on making sure that wherever the company lands with a buyer, it's a good home for people. It's a company that has good employee relations, that has a good culture. That culture fit is not to be underestimated at all. And so they'll be much more attuned to those kinds of questions. They're going to be very attuned to the financial aspects and the valuation, but they'll also be very interested in what that future looks like for their people.
Do you have the feeling that founders take the due diligence of the buyer, like doing their due diligence on the buyer, do they take it serious enough, or should they emphasize a bit more on that?
That's a good question. They probably should do a little bit more than they do. Really more so on that aspect of the culture, the fit, what the future business plan looks like, particularly for their business, that whatever they'll be part of after the deal.
Fair. I can imagine that there will be founders who are like, okay, we're more on looking for a new home, or we're more looking on the financial side. And either way, they will then be on the scale of we're doing due diligence to maybe not that much because we are just looking for the financial outcome, or a lot of due diligence because we're looking for the perfect way to also grow further and integrate the business successfully.
Yeah, and just be mindful though that not every element of the integration plan is going to be ironed out. It's rare, in fact, to have a full integration plan done before a deal is closed. I think that's the extreme. That would be the extreme exception. You should, as a seller or founder seller, you should really have your expectations set to having higher level, not necessarily vague, but higher level sense of how the company will be brought in, what the reporting lines will be, what the, again, the MO will be in terms of selling, in terms of delivering, in terms of how, if you're a technology company, how R&D might be integrated, things like that. So if not specific plans and tasks of an integration plan, at least concepts and guiding principles.
What would you say are the biggest misconceptions that founders, or let's say sellers in this case, because that makes it easier, have about M&A?
The biggest misconceptions that sellers have about M&A, I think, is probably how straightforward the process might be, or how, I won't say easy, I don't think anybody thinks it's easy, but maybe underestimating how much of the heavy lift it is. And it really is a heavy lift. Usually smaller companies don't have robust accounting systems, and so the financial and tax due diligence is going to require a lot of legwork, and that's not to be underestimated. I think just for a buyer who's doing the work, as I described earlier, doing the proper work of due diligence, it will be very intrusive, very time consuming, and you really need to be prepared for that physically and mentally.
Let's say you want to buy my company. What kind of preparation from my side and thought work will set me apart from the 99% of the rest of the deals that you might look at?
Yeah. So having all of your information for due diligence in good order and good shape, that alone would set you apart from everyone else. So whether it's having all of your contracts together, ideally you would already have a VDR, a virtual data room, set up, and you would have a folder with all your contracts and with all of your corporate documents and your board minutes or shareholder agreements or anything like that. You would have all of your trial balances and income statements, P&Ls, bank statements, tax documents, information about your employees, an employee census, history of attrition and recruitment. If you can just go through the list of everything you can think of, and this is where a good investment banker can be helpful. Now I'm sort of arguing against my own interest, because I prefer just one-off transactions that are not part of a process. But if you have somebody at least you can trust who's been through the process before and can help you think through and prepare, it's very useful. Also, quite a few companies, and this actually started more in Europe than the United States, quite a few companies go through a process called VDD, vendor due diligence, where they themselves hire somebody like a Big Four, for example, or maybe a smaller accounting firm, or maybe a smaller financial advisory firm, but sort of hire someone to do their own due diligence. So then they have that VDD report, and they've gone through sort of a mini due diligence process that helps them prepare. That can also be very useful.
I think these are all the questions that I have for today. I think a lot of more topics to cover on M&A, because it's definitely something that doesn't see it in one small podcast episode like we did it. But for a general understanding on how a process looks like from the buyer and the seller side, and getting a sense for what to look at if I'm thinking about selling my company, I hope we did a good job. Maybe you have some thoughts on if we are quite complete or if we left out a topic that we should have covered for sure. I think that's it from my side for now.
Yeah, no, thank you, Fabian. I would say that the most important thing is to be honest with yourself about what you're trying to achieve and why you're trying to achieve it, whether it's personally or for the business or for both. And then once you start from that step one, I think you can then make the right decisions, as long as you keep that in mind and just have all of your future decision points you have now reference to go back to of why am I doing this and why am I taking this next big step.
Jonathan, thank you so much. I'll put your LinkedIn in the show notes so that everybody can look at what you're doing, and also maybe you'll get the one or the other question. Let's see. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure. I can imagine that we'll have some questions and do another session at some point to go deeper and in some subtopics. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute honor.
Yeah, Dr. Shen, me too. Thank you, Fabian.